Life is unpredictable, but how you prepare for the unexpected shouldn't be. Take ownership of your life planning with Policy Genius to help your loved ones have a financial safety net in case something happens to you. Whether to cover debts and routine expenses or even invest the money and earn interest over time. With Policy Genius, finding and buying life insurance is simple. You can compare quotes from top insurers and could find coverage that fits your needs and your budget. Plus, they offer life insurance policies starting at just $276 a year for $1 million in coverage. It's an easy way to feel good about and plan for the future. No wonder Policy Genius is the country's leading online insurance marketplace. Don't wait for life to make other plans. Protect your family today. Head to PolicyGenius.com to compare top-rated life insurance policies, get your lowest quote, and make a smart move in under 10 minutes. That's PolicyGenius.com.
Welcome to The Deep Dive. Today, we are looking at a face that, well, you've definitely seen it. It's become such a fixture of modern cinema, instantly recognizable.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That iconic scarred visage, the long dark hair, the mustache.
The intense gaze. We are talking about Danny Trejo.
Machete himself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The man Hollywood just loves to cast as the ultimate, you know, the ubiquitous badass, the anti-hero.
But here's the thing, right? If you only know him for those characters, the assassins, the convicts, the really intimidating gangsters, then you are missing, well, the most extraordinary part of the story.
That's what we're diving into.
Yeah, the real deep dive here isn't just about the film roles, fascinating as they are. It's about the decades-long transformation of the man himself.
A huge transformation.
We're basically tracing his path from being, you know, a violent criminal and addict, someone who spent 10 years cycling through the absolute toughest prisons in California, even facing capital charges.
Facing the death penalty.
Right. From that to becoming this massively celebrated, successful entrepreneur, restaurateur, and maybe most importantly, fundamentally, a dedicated public servant and substance abuse counselor.
It truly is a remarkable arc of redemption, but it's one paved with some profound trauma.
Oh, definitely. And a commitment to change that was forged in, well, the most brutal circumstances imaginable.
So our sources for this deep dive, they give us a pretty comprehensive look, right? Chronological, thematic, covering his whole life.
Yeah, we'll move from that really harsh childhood, the deep immersion in crime and drug use,
all the way through to how he kind of accidentally stumbled into Hollywood.
And then built this whole multimedia and, you know, culinary empire. It's wild.
So the mission here is really to unpack that central paradox of his life.
Exactly. How did a guy who genuinely thought his life was destined to end behind bars?
Yeah.
How does he become a global icon whose films have grossed billions? And crucially, how does he do that while maintaining the integrity of the counselor he chose to become, what, 50 years ago now?
Right. So this is less about Machete, the movie villain.
And more about understanding the counselor behind Machete, the guy who ultimately embodied him, but is so much more.
Okay, let's unpack this journey then. Because the starting point, wow, it's incredibly dark. Rooted in instability, generational trauma.
Yeah, definitely. Danny Trejo, born May 16th, 1944. Maywood, California, raised mostly in working class areas like Echo Park and Pacoima.
And that background, it sounds like it set the stage for turbulence almost immediately.
Absolutely. His father, Denisio Dan Trejo, was a construction worker. And Danny's early life was just marked by severe abuse from him, physical, emotional.
Really tough start.
Yeah. And get this, one source notes that early on, the family actually had to flee L.A. for San Antonio, Texas for a bit.
Why?
Because his father was wanted by the police after stabbing a man. So, you know, this wasn't exactly a stable, sheltered upbringing we're talking about.
No kidding. And then the introduction to substance abuse, it happened staggeringly young, like almost guaranteeing that descent into crime.
The sources are really specific here. It was his uncle Gilbert, who was apparently a huge influence.
Not always a good one, it sounds like.
Well, no. He introduced him to substances.
Yeah.
Marijuana by age 8.
8 years old.
Yeah. Then heroin by age 12. And by 18, cocaine was in the mix.
And this wasn't just like trying things out.
No, not at all. The addiction was immediate, intense. Trejo himself described overdosing on his very first heroin fix.
Wow.
Facilitated by that same Uncle Gilbert. So this brutal early intro, it just fueled his criminal activity, which also started incredibly young. First recorded drug deal at age 7.
7. It's hard to even process that.
I know. And by age 10, that cycle, the one between crime and incarceration, it really began. First arrested, first time locked up in Eastlake Juvenile Hall, 1956.
So this wasn't just a one-off bad decision. This set a pattern.
Exactly. Dominated the next decade of his life. Juvenile Hall became like a revolving door for him.
And the incidents, they escalated pretty quickly in severity, right?
Oh, yeah. The sources talk about intermittent jail stints all through the 1960s, moving from juvie to adult places. We know he served 3 years at Camp Glenrocky in San Dimas.
What for?
For a really brutal crime, actually. Maiming a sailor. He stabbed him in the face with breaking glass.
Jeez. As a young man.
A very young man. That level of violence, it just shows the environment he was completely immersed in.
So the California prison system basically became his home turf between 59 and 69.
Pretty much. Cycled through the places that are, you know, infamous, synonymous with the toughest lockups in the U.S.
Right.
San Quentin, Folsom, Soledad, Vacaville, Susanville, Sierra. A terrifying resume, really, just of confinement.
And that context gives us one of the stranger historical footnotes I saw in the sources.
Ah, the Charles Manson connection.
Yeah. In 1961, he was in the L.A. County Jail temporarily, and he crossed paths with Manson.
Yeah, it's wild. Remember, this is years before the Tate-LaBianca murders, obviously. But Manson was already apparently kind of notorious in that jail environment.
What was Trejo's impression of him back then?
He described him as a, quote, dirty, greasy, scrawny white boy.
Okay.
But importantly, he also noted that Manson was supposedly a really talented hypnotist.
Mm-hmm.
And deeply charismatic, even that.
Strange encounter.
Well, it just shows the sheer chaotic mix of people thrown together in the L.A. jail system back then, right? The future Hollywood icon sharing space with a future cult leader, both just steeped in the criminal underworld.
It's a stark reminder of the violence and chaos that defined his life inside. But what's fascinating here is, even amidst all that, witnessing murders, being a debt collector, dealing drugs, he found this kind of paradoxical structure in one area, boxing.
Yeah, it says a lot about his, I guess, innate discipline, or maybe just survival instinct. Despite the drugs, the chaos, he focused intensely on physical training. He wasn't just surviving in there. He was actually excelling at something.
Became the lightweight and welterweight boxing champion at San Quentin.
Exactly. While incarcerated.
So think about that. He's simultaneously a drug dealer, an enforcer for internal debts, and a champion athlete whose reputation probably gave him some protection.
It's this complex, contradictory discipline, isn't it? And it kind of set the stage for the moment that finally forced a total shift, a massive prison riot.
Right, the pivotal moment, the 1968 Cinco de Mayo riot at Soledad Prison.
Yeah, it was chaotic, violent. And during the whole thing, Trejo, you know, heat of the moment, hits a guard with a rock.
Big mistake.
Huge. Led to him being immediately isolated, put in solitary confinement, and facing capital charges.
Meaning the death penalty was on the table?
Potentially, yeah. The gas chamber. That must have felt like the absolute end of the line.
Had to be his rock bottom.
It was. Totally isolated, no distractions, facing the ultimate consequence. The sources say that's when he finally, truly committed to changing his life. Completely.
What did he do in solitary?
Well, he found faith. He earned his high school diploma. And crucially, he successfully confronted and overcame those deep, decade-long drug addictions. Started a 12-step program right there, in solitary.
So that solitude, it became the forge for his redemption.
Pretty much. And the commitment he made then, it wasn't temporary, it stuck. It was the defining choice of his life. He said back in 2011 that he'd been sober for the preceding 42 years.
Incredible. So this wasn't just about getting out of prison, this was a fundamental overhaul. Spiritual, physical.
Yeah. He was released in July 1969. Served 5 years of a 10-year sentence. But importantly, his transition back to civilian life wasn't about waiting for Hollywood to call. Not at all.
What did he do?
It involved hard, stable work, reinforcing that structure he found in prison, boxing, and sobriety.
His pre-acting resume is actually pretty robust.
Yeah.
And it shows this dedication to, real labor.
Totally. Labor foreman helped build major L.A. landmarks like the Cinerama Dome.
No way.
Yeah. Gardener, salesperson, even part owner of a lawn care company. But the role that really defined his future, the one that eventually led him straight onto a film set,
was the substance abuse counselor job.
Exactly. A job he started and dedicated himself to since 1973, long before any acting.
Okay, so we've got this guy who successfully rebuilt his life. He's a devoted counselor, a hard worker. How does someone like that, a former prison boxing champ who's focused on helping addicts, accidentally end up in a major Hollywood movie? It sounds almost made up.
It is one of those incredible stories of, like, cosmic chance. And it all kicked off entirely within the context of his counseling work.
Right. He was working with a nonprofit.
Yeah, Western Pacific Med Corps, helping them set up sober living houses in the San Fernando Valley. And this work meant he had to be on call, like, constantly.
And that's what led to the phone call?
That's it. Late one night, 1985. Gets a desperate call. Not from an agent or anything. It was from a teenage patient.
A patient?
Yeah, who needed immediate help dealing with cocaine problems.
Mm-hmm.
Right there, on the set of a major Hollywood production.
Which movie?
Runaway Train.
Wow. So he literally shows up on a movie set as a counselor, focused only on intervention, helping his client, not looking for a career change at all.
Not in the slightest. It's the ultimate irony, isn't it? His commitment to service is what accidentally introduced him to the world of acting.
So what happened when he got there?
Well, he went, had the client, and then someone offered him a job as an extra, just to hang around the set for the prison scenes, look authentic.
And his motivation for taking it?
Two things, really. Easy money. It was like $50 a day, which wasn't bad then.
Right.
And he figured shrewdly that the publicity might actually help his counseling work, make him more recognizable to other potential clients who needed help turning their lives around.
So he saw acting, initially anyway, as just a way to fund his real passion, the counseling.
Pretty much. But that $50 a day extra job, it escalated really fast, thanks to a moment of recognition on set.
The Edward Bunker connection.
Exactly. Edward Bunker himself, a fascinating character, right?
Yeah.
Former career criminal turned respected crime author.
And he wrote the screenplay for Runaway Train.
He did. And Bunker immediately recognized Trejo. They'd done time together at San Quentin.
Must have been surreal, meeting again like that. One's a screenwriter, the other's a counselor, pretending to be an extra.
Totally surreal. And Bunker, remembering Trejo's reputation as the prison boxing champ, he leveraged that history instantly.
Ow.
He got Trejo a much better job, paid way more than being an extra, like $320 to
$350 a day. Damn,
what? As the personal trainer and boxing advisor for the lead actor, Eric Roberts.
Whoa, that's a huge jump in pay, just based on a skill he learned in prison.
Yeah, like seven times the daily rate. His reaction to that first paycheck, that big one, he said, "I thought they made a mistake," tells you everything about where he came from financially.
So it wasn't just coaching, though.
No. Bunker saw more. He saw that undeniable authenticity Trejo just radiated. So he convinced the director, Andrei Konchalovsky, to give Trejo a small acting role.
Arguing what? That he was real?
Basically, yeah. That his genuine experience as a former inmate would bring a reality to the prison drama that no trained actor could fake. That raw, lived reality. That was the spark that lit the fuse for his entire acting career.
His first credited film role came a bit later, right? Death Wish 4. The Crackdown in 87, Art Sinella.
Yep. And what's striking is how immediately and how persistently he got typecast.
Right. Straight into roles as inmates, gangsters, or other criminals.
Instantly. But here's the key thing, at least from his perspective back then. Trejo didn't see it as stereotyping or a limitation, not initially. He actually said, "I did not know I was being stereotyped. I just knew I was working."
Work was work.
Exactly. By 1989, just being an extra could bring him $700 in a good month. That was stable, honest income, a massive victory over his past, no matter what character he played.
Okay, but the film that really put him on the map, gave him that early persona, was Blood In, Blood Out in 1993.
Oh, yeah, that film was huge.
Yeah.
Gave him what the sources call legitimate worldwide fame, especially in the Chicano cinema world and beyond.
But filming it must have been intense for him.
Incredibly visceral. They filmed scenes at his actual former prison, San Quentin. He talked about how deeply uncomfortable it was shooting scenes in C-550.
Which was his old cell.
His exact former cell. For him, stepping back into that specific space wasn't just acting. It was dredging up really deep, painful memories.
And the stakes around that film, they weren't just on set, were they? They kind of bled back into the real criminal world he'd left behind.
Yes, this is a crucial, kind of scary detail.
Mm.
It highlights the real dangers he was still navigating. He claims he was initially offered the lead role, Pedro Santana, in Edward James Olmos's film American Me.
Okay.
But rumors started swirling fast within the criminal underworld, specifically involving the Mexican mafia. The word was the American Me script was taking, let's say, narrative liberties and revealing too much about their internal structure.
Oof, that sounds like a terrifying situation to be in.
It absolutely was. Before Trejo could even go to a second meeting with Olmos, he apparently got a call directly from Joe Pegleg Morgan.
The Don of the Mexican mafia.
A long time Don. known for being notoriously ruthless. Trejo claims Morgan essentially approved of him choosing the role in Blood In, Blood Out instead of American Me.
So it wasn't just a career choice, it was about survival.
It feels like it. Accepting Blood In, Blood Out was the safer, you know, sanctioned option. Avoided potential trouble.
That context adds incredible weight to those early career moves. Okay, let's connect this world, this authenticity and threat, to the actual craft of acting. His experience on Michael Mann's Heat in 1995 seems like a big learning moment.
Heat was absolutely a masterclass for him in subtlety, professionalism.
Oh.
And it started with another bizarre coincidence.
What was it?
Director Michael Mann initially mistook Trejo for his Uncle Gilbert.
The same Uncle Gilbert who introduced him to drugs?
No, another Uncle Gilbert, apparently. Yeah. Mann had met this Uncle Gilbert years earlier while shooting the Jericho Mile at Folsom. And this Gilbert was supposedly a significant shot caller inside the prison.
So Mann thought he was hiring this infamous shot caller's nephew, or maybe the shot caller himself.
He thought Trejo was Gilbert at first. So in honor of this Uncle Gilbert, Mann actually changed Trejo's character name in the script from Vince to Trejo.
That's a strange kind of honor.
Definitely rooted in respect for the authenticity that family name carried within that world. But more importantly, Heat is where Trejo really transitioned from just being an authentic presence to becoming a professional actor.
What did he learn specifically, especially working alongside legends like Robert De Niro?
De Niro apparently mentored him really patiently, acted as an instructive scene partner.
Mm.
Trejo talked about working these grueling 17-hour days alongside De Niro, Val Kilmer, John Voight.
Intense.
Yeah. And De Niro taught him that professional discipline you need for a major film production, learning to, quote, save their performances for when it mattered.
Meaning
don't burn yourself out during all the repetitive takes or the downtime. Keep that intensity ready for the moment the camera actually rolls. It's a kind of discipline, that expert application of energy. Uh-huh. It directly echoes the control he learned boxing in prison, doesn't it?
It really does. And the ultimate proof of his growing confidence on that set.
He and De Niro actually improvised the death scene for his character, Trejo.
They improvised it.
Yeah. To go from being this untrained extra just a few years earlier to improvising a critical dramatic moment with Robert De Niro. It just shows how rapidly he was adapting. Learning the craft, all while drawing on that deep well of life experience.
Speaking of connections from that time, the partnership that really defined his later career wasn't a former convict, it was family, though he didn't even know it at first.
Right, the Robert Rodriguez connection.
How did that happen? How did they find out they were related?
It's another one of those amazing accidents in his life. Trejo and Rodriguez, they're actually second cousins.
No way.
Yeah, and they had no idea until they were actually on set together filming Desperado in 1995. Rodriguez's sister, Patricia Vaughn, she's an actress too. She's also Trejo's second cousin.
So they figure this out on set, and once that connection's made, it just leads to this incredible, prolific run of collaborations.
Absolutely. Rodriguez immediately started casting him in roles that totally leveraged his intensity, but often with that characteristic Rodriguez wink, that sense of irony or fun.
Yeah, like in From Dusk Till Dawn in 96.
Yeah. And Once Upon a Time in Mexico in 2003, it became this hugely successful partnership.
But right before that whole Spy Kids era really launched his character into, like, global fame, Trejo faced a really serious private health crisis, one that threatened everything he'd built.
Yeah, that was tough. The sources mention that after he finished filming Animal Factory back in 1999, he contracted hepatitis C.
Oof, that must have brought back some terrifying echoes of his past, you know, the drug use, the prison time.
It had to be a massive blow, physically and mentally. And the illness hit him hard right as he was starting to film Spy Kids in 2000. He said he had to literally drag his ass to the set sometimes. Felt pale and weak.
And the critical thing here was the fear of people finding out in Hollywood.
Exactly. Why did he keep it a secret?
Fear of reprisal, right. Losing work.
Totally. In Hollywood, especially back then, the next job is never guaranteed. Disclosing a serious illness, especially one potentially stigmatized like Hep C, it could just derail a career. Particularly for someone like him, who had only relatively recently achieved stable success.
So during production, he was struggling intensely, even having trouble remembering lines.
Yeah, because of the side effects from the prescription medication he was taking. It was debilitating.
It gives you this really stark contrast, doesn't it? The world sees the ultimate tough guy on screen.
Machete.
But internally, he's fighting just to stay upright, keep his diagnosis hidden.
Thankfully, he battled through it. Fully recovered by the time the film premiered in 2002.
Yeah.
But despite that personal struggle, Spy Kids, that was the launchpad for his most iconic character ever.
Isidore Machete Cortez.
The one and only.
And Spy Kids, released in 2001, it just gave him this massive worldwide recognition. Completely changed his audience profile.
It really did. He went from being typecast as the scary convict that maybe only adults knew,
to being instantly recognizable and actually beloved by kids all over the world. That must have been profoundly surreal for a former Folsom inmate.
You have to imagine so. And the evolution of the Machete character itself, it's such a testament to the power of, like, self-aware branding.
How so?
Well, the character originally pops up in a kids film, right? Spy Kids. Then he transitions to that fictional trailer included in Rodriguez's big homage to exploitation films, Grindhouse, in 2007.
Oh, yeah, that trailer became legendary. It totally leveraged his intimidating persona, but for humor and over-the-top action.
It gained such a cult following just from the trailer that people were demanding a full movie.
So that led to Machete in 2010.
Yep, which the sources cite as his first major film role, where he actually played the title lead character.
Finally, the star.
It solidified him as this legitimate, maybe unconventional, but still legitimate action star. Followed up by the sequel, Machete Kills, in 2013, he finally broke out of just being the supporting criminal role.
But even with that worldwide fame, lead roles, the emotional scars from his past, they seem to stay pretty raw. There's that quote where he reflected on his success.
Yeah, it's powerful. He admitted, "I'm still scared that somebody's going to wake me up and say, hey, we're still in prison. Let's go to chow."
Wow, that just underscores how his success is constantly viewed through this lens of potential loss.
Absolutely. The trauma of incarceration runs so deep that all the comforts of Hollywood, the fame, it feels temporary, like a dream he could wake up from any second.
Yet that work ethic never stopped. He kept expanding his brand, taking lead roles like Frank Vega, the Vietnam vet in the Badass film series.
Right, starting in 2012, based on that viral epic beard man internet thing with Thomas Brusso.
And he moved into producing too.
Yeah, films like Ambition and Badasses in 2014, taking more control of his own narrative, his projects. And he maintains this remarkable currency in popular culture, even now.
Like appearing in huge franchises, The Book of Boba Fett recently.
As the Rancor Keeper.
Yeah.
Iconic. And just this year, 2024, voicing the Hawaiian mob boss, Dwight Mendez, in the video game, Like a Dragon, Infinite Wealth.
He is arguably more active now than ever before. It's incredible. Looking at his filmography, I mean, the sheer volume is just staggering. Over 250 film and TV roles. Maybe more now.
It's insane.
But his presence has saturated media way beyond live action stuff, especially in voice acting and gaming.
Oh, yeah. His voice.
Yeah.
It has that recognizable gravity, that authority. It translates perfectly to animation and games.
And often playing characters who are tough, but maybe secretly have a soft heart or are heroic, kind of mirroring that Machete persona.
Exactly. He was Mr. Jaguar in that amazing Pickle Rick episode of Rick and Morty.
Classic.
Vasquez, the protective bodyguard in Disney's Big City Greens. Roles in big animated movies like Storks, Minions, The Rise of Gru.
And he's a defining voice in the gaming world, too. Umberto Rabina in Grand Theft Auto, Vice City and Vice City Stories.
Huge roles, leveraging that gangster persona, but reaching this massive audience of gamers.
And not just criminal types, right? He voiced Raul Alfonso Tejada, the ghoul character in Fallout. New Vegas.
Yeah, a really memorable character in 2010. Plus, he's shown up as himself, or as a character based on him, in other huge titles. Def Jam, Fight for NY, Call of Duty. Black Ops, even DLC for Far Cry 6.
His voice just ensures that Danny Trejo is woven into the very fabric of interactive entertainment.
Pretty much.
But what's truly amazing, I think, is his pivot into entrepreneurship. This feels like the ultimate subversion of that bad guy image. He didn't just, like, slap his name on a restaurant. He built a genuinely successful, distinctive culinary empire in L.A.
Kicking off in 2016, yeah. This is where that self-aware branding really shines. It all started with Trejo's Tacos on La Brea Avenue.
And it grew fast.
Really fast. Expanded the brand to include Trejo's Cantina, Trejo's Coffee, and Donuts. Reports said 8 locations by 2020. And this whole venture, it feels really rooted in his commitment to the LA community, reflecting this accessible, authentic version of his persona.
And these places aren't just celebrity vanity projects, are they? The food's actually good.
Legitimately good. The sources highlight that his Rainbow Cauliflower Tacos, for instance, made the Los Angeles Times' list of their 10 favorite recipes back in 2017.
The flower tacos.
Yeah. That says something about dedication to quality and maybe a surprisingly healthy approach to Mexican food sometimes.
It's fascinating because you look at the Trejo's Tacos brand. His face is everywhere, the tough, tattooed, scarred image.
Right.
But the food itself, including vegan and vegetarian options, it's welcoming. It reflects this commitment to maybe a healthier lifestyle. It's a total contrast to the violence tied to his film roles.
And his business philosophy often reflects his counseling values, too. Mm-hmm. He actively hires ex-convicts.
Giving people second chances.
Providing opportunities for others to achieve the kind of redemption he found. Plus, they've expanded beyond L.A. now, I think Detroit and London.
Wow. Okay, so the food naturally led to books about it.
Yeah, the cookbook Trejo's Tacos. Recipes and Stories from L.A. came out in 2020. And even before that, he contributed to that compilation, Prison Ramen. Recipes and Stories from Behind Bars.
Those food books kind of act as bridges, don't they? Between his criminal past and his successful present.
Nicely put. But the definitive narrative, the one where he really took full ownership of his whole story, that was his memoir.
Trejo, My Life of Crime, Redemption, and Hollywood, 2021. Co-written with Donald Logue.
His longtime friend, yeah. And that book debuted at number 4 on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list. It's huge validation, right? Shows the public's real desire to understand the man behind the famous face.
And he has this massive media footprint that constantly plays on that tension, the scary image versus the reality. The perfect example has to be the Snickers commercial.
Oh, the Super Bowl commercial. Yeah. Where he played Marcia Brady.
Hilariously, a very angry Marcia Brady.
That commercial is iconic because it uses the weight, the gravitas of his persona purely for laughs. Mm. It shows he's totally in on the joke. He embraces the contrast.
And he uses that strong image to support other artists, too. Music videos.
Yeah, for totally diverse artists. Heavy metal like Slayer.
Repentless. Pride and Prejudice.
Hip-hop acts like Mobb Deep, Kid Frost. Even contemporary pop like Rosalia.
Yeah.
He just maintains credibility across all these different, sometimes conflicting, cultural spheres. It's amazing.
Okay, shifting into his personal life a bit. The sources summarize his relationships married and divorced 4 times.
Yeah, to Laura, Debbie Shipek, Joanne Descovo, and Debbie Shreve.
Mm.
And he has 3 children. Danny Jr., born 81, Gilbert, born 88, and Danielle, born 90.
And his reflection on those past relationships, it's really insightful. Speaks to that humility maybe required by the 12-step program he committed to.
Absolutely. He said, quote, I've tried to make amends with the women I've been involved with simply because it wasn't their fault I was broken.
That's taking real responsibility.
Yeah, acknowledging that his past, the unresolved trauma, the addiction, the intense focus on just survival, it made sustained, stable relationships really challenging until he'd done the work to heal himself.
That willingness is profound. And his distinctive look, the one Hollywood capitalized on, it also has a backstory rooted in that harsh youth, right?
Yeah, definitely. That heavily lined face, it's scarred not just by time, but specifically from severe cystic acne when he was younger, and just the physical toll of all those prison boxing brawls.
Right. And then, of course, the visual anchor, the thing you see in almost every role, that huge chest tattoo.
The Chara wearing a sombrero.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's iconic. The Chara often symbolizes strength, horsemanship, traditional Mexican identity. It ties his physical look directly to his cultural roots and that whole persona of the tough survivor.
And beyond the tough guy image, he's apparently a huge sports fan. Very passionate.
Oh, yeah. Total L.A. guy. Lakers, Dodgers, Kings, and Rams.
Yeah.
That's a point of pride for him. He even jokes about how he used to sneak through security fences at the L.A. Coliseum to watch Rams games back in the day.
Connecting his fandom now to his youthful rule-breaking days.
Yeah, exactly. But the real core, the immovable center of his legacy, it has to be his community service. His philosophy of contribution. We have to keep coming back to this. He has been a consistent active substance abuse counselor since 1973.
Way before acting, over a decade before Runaway Train.
This is the real foundation of a man, the bedrock of his stability. And the sources share this really moving story about his mentorship of a guy named Mario Castillo.
Tell us about that.
Well, Trejo met Castillo while they were both locked up. And Trejo, recognizing the destructive path Castillo was on, helped guide him towards sobriety inside.
And it stuck.
Yeah. After Castillo got out, they kept their bond. Castillo successfully overcame his addiction. But the mentorship didn't stop there. Now they actually speak together. Regularly.
Where?
At juvenile detention centers, recovery centers all over California, turning their shared history into this powerful message of hope and real possibility for other people struggling.
That practical boots-on-the-ground counseling work just never stopped for him, even when he was making huge movies, running restaurants.
Never stopped. And it all culminated in that incredibly high-profile moment back in 2019, the one that perfectly captured his philosophy in action.
You mean the car crash incident?
Yeah, in Sylmar.
Hmm.
He witnessed this violent crash. Two cars collided, one SUV flipped onto its roof.
And he didn't hesitate.
Didn't wait for emergency services. Just immediately ran towards the overturned vehicle and helped pull a 5-year-old child out of the wreckage. The kid was strapped in a car seat.
He was literally a hero in the purest sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Just showing this innate, immediate reaction to help someone in danger, so far removed from the scripted violence of his movie.
Totally. And his quote about that incident, it's the ultimate distillation of his whole life philosophy. It ties his redemption directly to his consistent practice of service. He said, "Everything good that has happened to me has happened as a direct result of helping someone else. Everything."
Wow. Everything.
He sees his health, his fame, his fortune. Not as rewards for his talent or his toughness, but as direct consequences of his choice to contribute, to help others. Hashtag tag outro.
So this deep dive into Danny Trejo, it's really showcased this extraordinary, almost unbelievable arc, hasn't it? From being locked up, facing the death penalty in solitary, in Soledad.
It's becoming one of the most prolific, instantly recognizable actors in Hollywood history.
All while building this multimedia brand rooted in, well, authenticity and redemption.
His life is just a masterclass in narrative control, when you think about it. The film industry tried, and still tries, to perpetually typecast him as just the disposable bad guy, you know, the violent, scarred image of Machete.
Right.
But his true self-written narrative, it's completely different. Counselor, author, culinary entrepreneur, mentor, dedicated public servant. He absolutely embraced the typecast for his career success.
But he never, ever abandoned that core counseling role, the role that defined his sobriety, his integrity, the role that actually got him onto that first film set.
Exactly.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, thinking about this? We see this constant tension, right, between the terrifying image of the violent anti-hero Machete
and the underlying reality of this life built on faith, humanity, dedicated service.
So the provocative thought maybe to take away is this. Danny Trejo achieved incredible professional success by, in a way, monetizing the cinematic consequence of his past. That image.
But he achieved genuine personal fulfillment, the stuff that clearly sustains him, by consistently choosing contribution over consequence. His career was built on the physical scar, you know. But his soul seems to have been rebuilt back in solitary, dedicated to helping other people find their own way out. It's a profound lesson, isn't it? About how owning your past, but actively choosing your purpose, can redefine even the most seemingly fixed destiny. That feels like a good place to wrap this deep dive.